with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Good evening, everyone, or good afternoon, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. And I have to say, it is very exciting to watch a person come to that process, that understanding of realization of everything that they've needed in this life has always been within, and just being a joy to journey with them to help them find their gifts and their graces and their skills and their strengths. It is indeed my joy. Well, if you are new to the program, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and mental health. And we do this by placing them within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and certainly our relationship with God or the divine. And it is my great pleasure to be with you here today and every Tuesday, 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me comments about tonight's show, which I always enjoy reading, please visit www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Now, some other good news that I had shared last week, I'll share with you this week, that you can also access these broadcasts via iTunes. So if you have that capability, please go ahead, and that way you don't miss a show, or you can go back and you can listen again. So again, you can catch these broadcasts on the iTunes channel. And if you would like to be part of this show, please call in. I always enjoy talking to our callers. Dial the number 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, how is your heart today? I hope that wherever you are today, you are safe and your heart is at peace. Well, before we get into today's subject, I just want to say a quick word about next week's show, next Tuesday, July 21st. Can you believe we are in the middle of July? But that show is entitled, When Our Struggles Lead Us Home. When Our Struggles Lead Us Home. And we're going to be focusing on exactly where our struggles just take us in this life and the journeys that we're on. Because one of my favorite quotes comes from T.S. Eliot. Perhaps you've heard it before, very famous. He says, we shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all of our exploring, we will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. So just a heads up for next week, that show entitled When Our Struggles Lead Us Home. Well, as I said, I'll be taking your calls in the second half of the show today, and I encourage you to call in because I really want to get to your heart on today's subject. Change equals loss equals grief. Now, ironically, this is a paradigm that was shared with me by one of my best teachers when I was going to graduate school, Dr. Shep Jeffries. And I'll just share with you just a simple story real quick. I was taking one of his courses on loss and grief, and it was a summer course, and so it was just hotter than you can imagine. And it was in the evening, which nobody really wanted to be there because it seemed like every one of our evening classes, there was always this beautiful sunset. And so it was just one of those trade-offs like, well, okay, if we have to be in class, then we'll make it up somehow, some way, and we'll catch the next beautiful sunset. But I was actually the first one in the class, and Shep was still getting the room set up, as it were, for the evening course. And there was about 11 or 12 of us in that summer class that I was taking. And when I first saw Shep, I couldn't believe my eyes. because if those of you out there in the audience, if you remember the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you'll remember Lou Grant, or the character Lou Grant. Well, that is who Shep Jeffries reminded me of. He, you know, was about his height, a little heavier, but he wore these white short sleeve shirts and black pants and white socks and black shoes. And he had these big, hairy arms, just like Lou Grant. And I remember, you know, I went in, I introduced myself, and he was very happy to see me. He told me to pick a chair, any chair, and I did. And I continued to watch him set up the room. And he had the chairs, not desks, but he had these chairs in a semicircle so that we would be looking at one another. And I just said to myself, oh, great, here we go. And after he was done arranging the chairs, he went and he got several boxes of tissues. And he started to place a box of tissues in front of like every third or fourth chair or so. And of course, you know, what in the world do we need these for? And so more and more people started to come in. We introduced ourselves and so forth. And of course, everybody's eyeballing these tissues. And it happened to come time for class to start. And we didn't open any book. We didn't go through over the syllabus or any like class rules and regulations or expectations and assignments. But Shep, he moved his chair right in the middle of us. And he started to share his story, his own personal story of loss and grief. He started to share very personal losses and his expectations and assumptions about life that were just so challenged. It literally, as he put it, shattered him. It broke him in two. And oftentimes his voice would crack as he was sharing these stories. And now, you know, in hindsight, I know now why he put out those tissues, because within the first hour, let alone the first 30 minutes of Shep sharing his stories, we were literally diving for the tissues, and we couldn't get to them fast enough. We would take two or three tissues and pass them to the next person. There was that much of a transformation going on within the first hour, and it was pretty intense to say the least, but it was all shared from his heart. And it was just very, very powerful. I mean, what a way to begin a summer class. And I knew at that moment that the course on loss and grief was not going to be clinical. It was not going to be sterile. It was going to be very experiential. And so after he was done sharing, he said, okay, let's all take a break. We'll come back after 15 minutes, and then we'll jump in and get started from there. And we were exhausted by the first hour, and we just couldn't, you know, believe that as we talked to each other over the break, it's like, oh my gosh, what's he going to do next? Because we have three more hours with him. But every week was like that. He just shared from his heart, and he definitely made an impact on my life, and just the powerful transformative effect of working through our losses. But his paradigm, change equals loss equals grief, had always stayed with me. It was just something he just said, look, if you never learn anything else in this course, learn this, because you can apply this to all aspects of your life. And we talked about the different changes that we all go through. We talked about the changes that we prepare for, such as perhaps, let's say, graduation, or we work hard and we work for that promotion. And we get that promotion. Or let's say you get married. That's a very powerful change right in and of itself. But he says that whenever we go through these changes, or even moving away for that job promotion, it's going to kick up a sense of loss in us. It's going to create that sense of we're losing that which was familiar to us, that which we knew, that which we became comfortable with. And he says it doesn't necessarily have to be a negative thing. Like you said, the positive things in our life, like graduations and promotions and weddings and so forth, can also kick up these feelings that we're, in a sense, losing something. But he also reminded us about how we can take on something better as well. And of course, this change equals loss equals grief was applied to certainly what do we do when we experience the death of a loved one, perhaps the most painful losses in our life. And of course, he said any kind of change is going to kick up a sense of loss. And where there is a sense of loss, we are going to need to grieve it. Because if we don't grieve it, it's going to build up in us. And we're going to really feel it physically, emotionally, psychologically, even spiritually. But I tell you, from firsthand experience with my own losses and counseling those who are struggling with their own losses as well, we're going to feel it physically. Because if grief is not able to be processed, it's going to bounce around in us, and it's going to come out in terms of severe headaches or stomach issues or back issues or wherever we hold that tension and that grief in our bodies. And again, I'm not the first one to come up with the idea that we hold grief in our bodies. This actually goes back to around 1940, 1942, where there was Dr. Eric Linderman, and he was working at Massachusetts General Hospital. And he did some very groundbreaking work. He just made some simple observations, and it was just powerful nonetheless, because as he was treating people for ulcerative colitis, he started to talk to them. And he started to ask simple questions such as, what's been going on in your life, and so forth. And the people would start to share with him, the losses that they would have, especially the loss of loved ones that they've never really had a chance to adjust to, or perhaps never had a chance to fully grieve. Well, 9 months later, in and around the town of Boston, there was this Coconut Grove nightclub fire. You can Google it. I mean, it was just a horrific fire where over hundreds and hundreds of people had died. And this fire set precedents for new revisions in how restaurants lay out their doors. Because you see, at the time, at that particular nightclub, if you were on the inside of it, the doors you had to pull towards you. You just couldn't push them out. And that was the problem. When the fire was, raging and the people tried to get out, just because the crowds pushed against the doors, they couldn't back up enough to pull the doors to them and get out. But that changed with, fire codes and safety and all that. But Dr. Linderman also was treating people, the survivors of the loved ones who had died in that fire, he was treating them for ulcerative colitis. And again, he would ask them, about the fire and how they were coping and so forth. And he started to make this connection about where grief lands in the body, namely ulcerative colitis and unhealed grief or unprocessed grief. And so he was the first one to make that connection as to where grief lands in the body. And it just opened up our understanding in terms of research and how grief is manifested in our lives. And that story leads us into what's really important when it comes to being able to process our losses. And in fact, it really helps us, I think, in understanding the differences between our wounds and our scars. And here's what I mean by that. If you ever have a chance to meet me, or maybe you have met me, ask me next time about my scar on my left thumb. Just a short story here about it. I was 17 at the time, and I was working on a mock roofing project, and it was a mock project. It was designed to teach us how to shingle a roof properly. And we were working in teams, and my task at the time was to cut the smaller sections of shingles so that they would fit at the end of each row. And it was about an hour before quitting time, and of course, as with most avoidable accidents, I was in a hurry to finish the job. I mean, I wanted to go home. Well, with my straight edge in one hand and my, very quickly becoming dull utility knife, I began to score the section that needed to be cut. And on or about the fourth pass, the knife seemed to jump across the straight edge and right across my left thumb. And I finished the day right through dinner time in the emergency room, getting 7 stitches for my haste. Well, reflecting on that experience has taught me a lot about the natural progression of recovering from painful experiences. I mean, when I was cut, I experienced the excruciating pain of a fresh wound. And in the days that followed, if you've ever had a cut like that that needed stitches, whenever I accidentally bumped my thumb, well, the pain and the blood reminded me that although the wound was stitched, healing was still a long way off. Well, now, decades, and I mean decades later, I'm still reminded of that day, not because of the pain that I have, but because of the scar. I can look at that scar and I can remember exactly what I was doing, where I got that scar, how much it hurt in the moment, and what I've learned as a result. And let's face it, all of us have scars from previous wounds. Some are more obvious than others, such as a wound from a surgery or a wound from an accident. Other scars, however, are not so obvious. You know, these scars resulting from, let's say, certain emotional or spiritual wounds are often kept hidden from others, deep within our hearts, deep within our souls. And very rarely do we permit others to touch these wounds because we ourselves have never healed from them. Some wounds are still fresh, even though they're 5, 10, 15, or more years ago. In these instances, yes, a scar has formed, and other times a scar has never formed because we've never allowed the healing process of within to take place. Because metaphorically speaking, we are constantly poking at the wound, scratching open that scab and reliving the painful memories all over again. And despite our mother's warnings that it'll never heal unless you stop picking at it, we still apply those temporary band-aids of either prescription drugs or illegal drugs or alcohol, or we use, let's say, repression or denial or some other sedating relief. The same process could also be said regarding finding healing from emotional wounds of loss and grief. Now, there is still a common misunderstanding out there that once we have assimilated our losses or once we have moved on from our losses, that we will never go back to where we were before the loss. You know, that original emotional or, let's say, psychological, that spiritual state. But this return to the way things were rarely happens. Instead, we're constantly being shaped and changed by our losses. And this is what I mean by that. Once we've experienced a loss, our outlook on life is forever altered by the grief we sustain. And the reason for this is because our assumptions about life and the world in which we live have now been challenged, if not shattered. We've become accustomed to our daily routines, which define our existence. And furthermore, we will never see ourselves and others or the world the same as we once did because we're pulled into this task of trying to make sense out of new circumstances in light of the old. Yet, instead of moving on from our losses or instead of assimilating our losses into our everyday lives, many people resist this healing by continuously living in a prison of bitterness. Bitterness that's being reinforced by these familiar patterns of abuse and low self-esteem and feelings of unworthiness or contempt or jealousy or strife or whatever. The list goes on and on and on. And instead of being able to see the potential of how we can be made better by our losses, we allow bitterness to harden our hearts and to keep others out, all the while cementing the anguish inside. And this is very, very easy to do. In fact, it's so easy, maybe you've said this already. Maybe you've said, I'm never going to, you know, whatever it is, fill in the blank. and we feel our hearts close off. We feel those wounds just being cemented inside. But the challenge then is for us to discover that courage, to redefine ourselves in light of our pain and our grief. And yet, in the process of doing this, something else compels us to ask this question. In this process, is this something that we're able to do on our own, or do we need the help of others? Can we really just work through our own changes, our own loss, our own grief, all by ourselves? Or is there something to be said for having a community of others, the support of family, let's say the support of a faith community? Well, today, when I look at my thumb, I see more than just a scar, more than just a reminder of a painful time in my past. I also see a thumbprint, something we all have in common. No two are alike. It's fascinating. It's what identifies us as unique among other characteristics. And these thumbprints, these fingerprints, are one of the most distinguishable parts of our bodies. I mean, if you've ever, given birth to a baby, hospitals certainly record them as a means of identifying newborns and their mothers. Some even, do a thumbprint of the father. Certain jobs require applicants to get fingerprinted for employment, and even people who have been arrested have their prints taken as a matter of legal record. But all in all, thumbprints, fingerprints can tell a lot about us. And so do our scars. They identify what wounds we have suffered as a result of the past, by what accidents we've endured, or what mistakes we have made, or surgeries, or unfortunate mishaps of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the same could be said for our bereavement. And we all experience loss and grief throughout our lives, and just like no two thumbprints are alike, so too no two people grieve in the same manner or react similarly to the parts of the loss experience. I always kind of cringe when we hear advice given to people who have lost a loved one, well, it's been 6 months now, you should be over it. And that's just simply not the case. There are other unique factors that go into how long we grieve the loss of loved ones, or how long we grieve, let's say, the changes that we go through. No two people are alike. No two people will grieve the same way because no two people have the same thumbprint. But when communities are a part of the healing process of loss and grief, they also empower others to then let go of their pain and be redeemed from their losses. And in our search for meaning following a loss, we often overlook the relationship between how we view ourselves and how we view others in bereavement. And as a community of faith, people are always in a relationship with themselves and others and God. Those three associations can never be separated. And how we see ourselves, as well as what we tell ourselves about ourselves, is just as important as how we see others and our relationship with God. Well, there is a natural progression to healing that takes place in our bodies whenever we are wounded. Just talk to any doctor, okay? But let's keep this in the context of the scar on my left thumb. Initially, when I cut my thumb, there was immediate pain and blood. Medical experts tell us that the pain is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, they would say, well, it's your body's way of telling you that there's something wrong. The pain can be excruciating at times, which is, again, our body's way of telling us there's something really wrong. As a little kid, perhaps you put your hand on a hot stove and just in a blink of a second, the pain signals tell the brain, get your hand off the stove now. And if our bodies weren't able to do this, we would risk further serious injury. But at any rate, when we are cut, we bleed. And again, it's our body's way of not only telling us that there's something wrong, but the blood is also there to help cleanse the wound from dirt. And of course, we need to stop the bleeding at some point, or often sooner rather than later. However, some people who have lost some or all of the feeling in part of the body have to exercise extreme caution, as they could accidentally cut themselves and not be aware of it. And if you've ever cut yourself deep enough, you know a scab forms. At this point, when you think about it, it's really a healing from the inside out that's occurring. And if, let's say, you cut yourself deep enough, you needed stitches and or maybe even taking antibiotics to ward off an infection. And then once the wound has been healed, the scab dries up, it falls off. And depending on the depth and size of the wound, a scar, it will remain there as a constant reminder of what you went through. And of course, the deeper the wound, the more intense the pain will be, and the longer this healing process will take. And during this process, many people are able to find some relief from the pain through, medications and so forth. Okay, and that is a very good thing. I mean, think about it this way. Just go to your medicine cabinet and take a quick inventory of everything located there. What do you find? Aspirin, antacids, cold sore gel, lip balm, arthritis medication, whatever. These are all things we can buy over the counter. And yet some people will anesthetize themselves from the pain through illegal drugs or alcohol or another means of escaping what is unbearable to them. And this is certainly true when it comes to the emotional pain or the psychological pain or even the spiritual pain that we go through. That kind of pain can be just as intolerable, but what takes away that pain? That kind of pain, aspirin will not touch. Advil will not touch. Alcohol will not touch. That pain is deep within. The scars are there, and the pain continues to be real. So what does all this have to do with our woundedness, whether it be emotional or otherwise? Well, quite simply, everything. As I said, physical pain can be unbearable. So too can emotional pain. The emotional distress in our lives often inflicts the wounds that we cannot see in each other, but they do affect the ways that we see ourselves and others and God. And many people who suffer from loneliness may fail to see how they push others away with their, let's say, cutting remarks, or they fear that others are getting too close. It's like they may hold people at a distance because it's too painful when people brush up against those emotional wounds. But as a society still, I mean, here we are in 2020, and as a society, we still do not do well with loss and grief and bereavement. We're getting better. I'll have to admit, we are getting better. In fact, one of the things that I am just thoroughly grateful for is whenever you go to the store and you want to buy a sympathy card for somebody, there's just a whole examples of sympathy cards out there. Especially now, you can find sympathy cards for those who you want to send to who have experienced the death of a pet. I think that's ingenious, and quite frankly, it's about time, because for the longest time, there was nothing there for people who are grieving the loss of a pet. It was just one of those kinds of losses that were just never spoken. It was experienced by many, many people, but you didn't know what to say, because for the longest time, pet loss was not considered, that important because, well, it wasn't a human being. But, don't try to tell me that we don't get attached to our animals just as much, if not more. So when Hallmark and American Greetings and those other, you know, greeting card companies started to come out with, you know, sorry for your pet loss cards, that was ingenious. And that also gives people permission to talk about the animals that have become so attached to them, and they are like family members. Well, in our losses, I believe that many times we think that we go through and with our losses, we think something is happening to us that is so exclusive that nobody can understand what we're feeling. Nobody can understand what we're going through. Nobody can get it. We tend to forget about the other side of the thumb, so to speak. In fact, the change, the loss, the grief, the death, these are all universal. These are events and experiences that we all face because we exist. And as universal as the events, we can never minimize another person's loss. We just can't do that because it's still unique to them. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, please do so now. The number is 800-627-6008. That's 800-627-6008. And like I said, I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in about 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, just a quick word about next week's show. That show is entitled, Where Our Struggles Lead Us. Where Our Struggles Lead Us. So I invite you to tune in then next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time. Well, earlier, we were talking about this paradigm that was shared with me by my teacher, Shep Jeffries. Change equals loss equals grief. And a common misunderstanding is that once we've worked through our losses or assimilated our losses, we're going to go back to the way things used to be in our lives. You know, that original emotional and spiritual state, perhaps that, you know, the original psychological state in which we saw things as innocent as before. But this return to the way things used to be rarely happens. Instead, we are forever changed by our losses. And once we have experienced a loss, our outlook on life is forever altered by this grief that we sustain, this grief that has to be worked through. Otherwise, it'll continue to hold on to us physically, emotionally, psychologically, even spiritually. And the reason for this is because our assumptions about life and the world in which we live have now been challenged, if not shattered. Loss is universal. Pain and death and dying are also universal. As I was preparing for this show, I was reminded of a story I came across years ago about how death and dying is very much a part of everyone's life. There is an ancient story out there about a bereaved mother who had brought her child who had died to a holy man to be healed. She begged the master to have pity on her and to return her child to life. The master was taken very much by her story and her grief, and he agreed to do so, but first, only if she would bring him a mustard seed from a house in her village where death had not been. Well, initially, the woman was excited because this request seemed so simple. I mean, she thought, surely there must be at least one house where death has not visited. And after walking for some time, coming down from the mountain and into the village, she arrived at the first house, and she asked if they had any mustard seeds for her. And she was delighted when she heard they had plenty to give. However, when she told them that the seed had to come from a household where death had not visited, they told her that it was just last year that they buried their father. Well, she was disappointed, but she was still hopeful, and so this woman moved to a second house and asked if they could give her a mustard seed. And again, the family had plenty of seeds to give her, but when she heard that they, too, had buried a loved one, she couldn't accept the seed. On and on and on, the woman went from one house to another, searching for a family who had been spared from death. But to her dismay, she didn't find one. And eventually, she came to understand the wisdom of the master, that death comes to all. So silently, she returned to claim her son, and she returned home to bury him in peace. Death and dying are universal. The pain that we experience is universal. And as much as we would like to think that we can get through it ourselves, we can tough it out, we can work through our losses, we can make sense of everything, and we can work through whatever theology or assumptions or whatever the case may be by ourselves, is really not the case. We do need the support from others. In fact, this was something that I had seen in my own research, and we're just working with people and counseling them from, you know, death and dying, you know, and their bereavement, that the ones who are able to work through their losses, not faster, not quicker, but more completely, were the ones who had a strong family or another social support. They knew that they could call and they would be supported. They knew that as they shared their story, they would be listened to. They would be understood. And they knew that no matter how many tears they cried, people would join them in crying too. That's the support families and communities ought to be providing for one another. I am convinced that our losses can be very painful at times, so painful that we need the help of others to remind us of the positive aspects of life, to remind us that, yes, we will work through this. We will never forget our losses. They will always be part of our memories, but it's the pain in the memory determines how well and to what degree we've been able to work through our losses, to make sense of them, to come to some peace about them. Many years ago, I visited Ken Doka, who had done extensive research in the area of hospice. And as we sat in his office at the College of New Rochelle in the Bronx, we talked about the importance of rebuilding, as he put it, faith in philosophical assumptions that have been challenged by our losses, that have been challenged by our grief. And what impressed me the most about our conversation was how he explained how most of us live our lives according to our assumptions, and how grief causes us, actually forces us, to re-examine our core beliefs about how life ought to operate, the way things we think should be done, or at least how we think life should unfold. Think about it this way. From the time that we were young, our lives are built upon assumptions, let's say, how the world should work, or when and how God should answer our prayers, or how and when God should act, and even our assumptions about matters of faith and obedience and rewards and punishment and so forth. And you know what the most ironic thing is about our assumptions? They come to us in the form of fairy tales and bedtime stories. That's how early the formation of these assumptions begin in our lives. And although they are loved and cherished by young and old, they nevertheless involve some very intense pain and dark experiences. That is, these nursery rhymes, these fairy tales, and bedtime stories. If you've ever read anything from the Brothers Grimm, to put it mildly, these were two, let's say, twisted individuals in and of themselves. They were a little out there. They had a vivid imagination. And the irony is that they were librarians. And this was back around, you know, the early 1800s, like around 1810, 1812. And they themselves told some pretty twisted tales that have been made into, stories that have gone through several revisions down through the ages. And they've been cleaned up, so to speak. And so they always have these wonderful themes of, and they lived happily ever after. Here's one example. You've heard of Snow White, right? That was an original Brothers Grimm tale. And overcome by her jealousy of Snow White, the wicked witch devises a plan to kill her, and she convinces others that she has succeeded. You know the famous line, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? Yet, in the end, she meets her doom at the hands of a prince. And what do Snow White and the prince do? They ride off into the sunset, and they live happily ever after. And the story is tied up in some nice little neat bow. The same thing is true with Cinderella, or as the Brother Grimm usually, I should say, told it in the first place, it was called The Glass Slipper. And the story of Cinderella is that her stepmother and her sisters treat her cruelly and break her heart by not allowing her to go to the ball. But by the end of the story, the wicked stepmother and the stepsisters, their plan unravels, and Cinderella and the prince live happily ever after. And this is the true, you know, with many, many other stories that the Grimm brothers had written about, that had told, but had been cleaned up because, well, we want a happy ending. And we grow up hearing these stories and listening to these stories, and we just think, well, this is how life should work. Life should be a fairy tale. Life should be a dream. Life should be, you know, and we live happily ever after. But unconsciously, whenever we experience the pain of losing a loved one to death, those unchallenged assumptions about life and the fairness of the world and even the goodness of God often muddy the waters of how we grieve. I mean, unconsciously, we may wonder, how come we're not allowed to live happily ever after? Or question, what have I done that God is punishing me? And yet the truth is that death and dying are very much a part of life and living. But hopefully, this awareness of our mortality and ultimately who we are eternally awakens us to become better, not bitter, persons of faith, stronger people in the community to help one another work through our losses. And yet, if we think about it, once we're able to comprehend that death is real, as we get a little bit older, and we realize that, yes, someday we too shall die, despite how difficult that might be for us at that time, our worldview starts to change. It changes from this naive innocence of life and pleasure and being cared for to perhaps a realization that we now must confront our own sickness, our own aging, our death, our mortality. Well, one of my favorite books is about an ancient story told of the spiritual journey of an Indian man named Siddhartha, who lived during the time of the Buddha. And within Buddhism itself, there's a belief that there is nothing fixed and permanent in this world. Everything and everyone is subject to change, or as the Buddha taught, is in a continuous becoming. And I like that, a continuous becoming. And nowadays, we refer to this as impermanence. And if you've ever sat beside a river and watched its flow, you get the idea where impermanence comes from. We watch the water run from point to point and around rocks or fallen branches, finding the way of least resistance. And yet at the same time, the river is not one continuous and unified flow. The river of this moment is not going to be the same as the river of the next moment. And it's not going to be the same after that, and after that, and after that. It's always changing. And this is where the saying from the ancient philosopher Heraclitus comes from: you cannot step into the same river twice, for other waters are ever flowing onto you. You cannot step into the same river twice, for other waters are ever flowing onto you. And we can certainly apply this to our lives. None of us remain the same throughout the years. And we might kid ourselves and think, well, I'm not changing. I'm the same old person. That's not true. We are changing, trust me. The various stages of our lives, from childhood to adulthood to old age, we are not the same at any given moment. The child is not the same when he or she grows up and becomes a young adult, nor when she or he grows into an elderly person. And while it's true that we live from moment to moment, we tend to forget that each moment leads to the next. Impermanence and change are thus the undeniable truths of our existence. Well, I feel like I'm sharing all these stories with you tonight, and I'm going to share one more because that is how I've been taught. And if there's ever a great teacher in your life, that person will indeed share stories, not because they're old, but because stories have a way of imparting truth to a point that we get it. Okay. And so Joyce Rupp, who is a Servite nun, and she wrote a book called Praying Our Goodbyes. It's a spiritual companion through life's lessons of loss and sorrows. Praying Our Goodbyes. She has just some wonderful, just practical, clever ways that we can work through our losses. And I'll share one if I have more time at the end. But I do want to share with you her whole point in writing this book and why goodbyes are so difficult for us. She says that typically in any given day, we say goodbye from 20 to 30 times. You know, these goodbyes can include saying goodbye to loved ones after they go off to work or school, or saying goodbye to people we meet at the grocery store or wherever else we are. Even saying goodbye to someone whom we've been talking to on the phone. Now, these goodbyes don't seem to trouble us because we tell ourselves that, well, I'll see that person again, or I can always just, you know, pick up my phone again and I can talk to that person one more time. Well, what about the goodbyes that do trouble us, such as saying farewell to our loved ones upon their death? These goodbyes may trouble us deeply because we may not be ready to say goodbye. We may not be ready to come to that closure, what the word means. We want more time. We want to be in charge of when and where we take our leave. But you know what the neat thing is about the word goodbye is? It was never understood as something permanent. It was never understood like, okay, that's it. I'll never see you again. I'll never talk to you again. So goodbye. That's not the original meaning. The original meaning of goodbye actually is a word, or I should say words that have been jammed together, as in God be with ye. Goodbye. God be with ye. In other words, till we see each other again, God be with thee. We even have a benediction that people in church say, may the Lord watch between me and thee while we are absent one from another. So goodbye was never intended to be something permanent. And this is something that we keep in mind because we have that blood-soul connection with our loved ones. Yes, we will be saying goodbye to them, and physically they will no longer be with us, but we will always have the stories. We will always have the memories. And let's also be honest with us. Sometimes those memories will not be pleasant. Sometimes the memories themselves will be downright painful. So what do we do with that? That also needs to be worked through as we are grieving. That pain also needs to be come to terms with and healed in a way that speaks life. Well, whenever I counsel others, people who are struggling with loss or grief or bereavement, sooner or later we get on the subject of what else is coming up for you. And they may have other symptoms of depression or anxiety or general negative feelings about life itself. And sooner or later, the stories will turn to loss. And more than just the death of a loved one, there are other losses that they begin to talk about. Loss of a divorce. Loss because of a job transfer. Loss because they decided to change careers. Loss because of a promotion and they worked hard to get. Loss because of a marriage and now their family has doubled in size. Or loss of a failed relationship or loss of graduations. What am I going to do now after I graduate? I'm so used to going to school. Now what? Now I have to get out there and work, or now I have to do something else. And what can I do? Or there might be loss from broken dreams or broken dates, broken hearts, and so forth. And in reflection with the clients who come to me, I often ask them, what losses have been the most difficult for you? How old were you when you had your first loss? What do you remember about it? How did you feel at that time? What part of yourself did you lose, and how much of yourself do you wish to have back again? And this is where we get into some very, very interesting stories, interesting sharing. But that's also where the good stuff is in terms of the healing. I will leave you with one more story. Some people in remote villages of China have a custom when a woman is married, she's given a double-sided mirror by her mother. And when the groom arrives at her home to take his bride to live with his family, she first looks at her face in the mirror as a reminder of her past. And this image in the glass helps her remember who she is and from where she has come. And she is never to forget her family, her heritage, her former way of life. And halfway through this journey to her husband's home, she is then told to turn the mirror over and again look at her face. But this time, instead of remembering her heritage, she is able to see who she is, her presence, her future as a wife and a mother. Now, we may not carry around two-sided mirrors, but you get the point. We may find it difficult to see ourselves in the present, let alone the future, because we have trouble getting beyond the past. And therein lies the healing from our losses. Can we see who we are yet to become? Can we see ourselves capable of healing and capable of living a life of wholeness and peace? And that is my prayer for you this week. Again, my name is Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. That is my prayer for you, that you will continue to work through your losses. I ask that you would continue to send me messages, write to me, and let us share one another's stories. Until next week, be safe, take care, and may God bless you. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.